This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, sports fans. This is USA Today Sports on Friday, May 3rd, read by Jim Gronfeld. First front page article is by Jason Frakes on horse racing. He writes for the Louisville Courier-Journal and USA Today Network. It's the 150th Kentucky Derby. Fierceness, Sierra Leone are top two contenders. Dateline, Louisville, Kentucky. A two-year-old champion versus a multi-million-dollar yearling purchase. A speedster versus a closer. A well-built colt versus impeccably made masterpiece. Saturday's Kentucky Derby at Churchill Downs will offer its usual wealth of storylines. But the 150th run for the Roses starts with two horses featuring strong, though not perfect, resumes. Fierceness is the 5-2 morning line favorite after the most impressive performance of the prep season, a 13.5-length romp in the Grade 1 Florida Derby at Gulfstream Park. A wow moment, trainer Todd Pletcher said after the race. Sierra Leone is the 3-1 second choice and enters off a victory in the Grade 1 Bluegrass Stakes at Keeneland. The Chad Brown trainee has won 3 of 4 career races, losing by a nose in the other, and carries a $2.3 million price tag, the highest of any horse nominated to the 2024 Triple Crown races. Trainer Brad Cox has the third choice on the morning line in Louisiana Derby winner Catching Freedom, and sees Fierceness and Sierra Leone as worthy adversaries. They deserve to be the two favorites. There's zero doubt about that, Cox said. They're good horses, two world-class trainers. You have one who's probably going to be up close, Fierceness, and the other one, Sierra Leone, should come running, so you better be ready. Fierceness' talent outshines his stature. A son of City of Light, Fierceness is a homebred for owner Mark Repole. He described the horse as laid back and calm. He's not one of those Uncle Mo's, 16-something hands, big, Repole said. He's just a well-built, balanced colt, beautiful looking. But he's not a horse if you line them up and said, who are you going to draft in the first round? He's not one of those. But you can't measure heart and ability and talent, and that's what you get out of him. He made a lasting first impression, winning his debut last August over a muddy Saratoga track by 11.25 lengths. But he followed with a disappointing showing in the Grade 1 Champagne at Aqueduct, bobbling at the start and finishing 7th. It was the beginning of what's been an up-and-down career for Fierceness, winning the Grade 1 Breeders' Cup Juvenile at 16-1 odds. A third place showing in the Grade 3 Holy Bull and his 3-year-old debut, and then the dominating performance in the Florida Derby in which he earned a field-best 110 buyer speed figure. Pletcher had a humorous response, paraphrasing a line from the movie Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy, to describe Fierceness' good race, bad race history. 60% of the time, he wins every time, Pletcher said with a laugh. I think if you go back and look at the two replays of his losses, they're very similar. In the Champagne, he hopped at the start, and then he got bumped pretty solidly and took him out of his rhythm a bit. And the Holy Bull was a very roughly run race into the first turn. He got sandwiched from both sides. Thankfully, everything went much smoother in the Florida Derby, and he was able to show what he's all about. Sierra Leone, impeccably made and bred. A son of Gunrunner, Sierra Leone is owned by the conglomerate of Mrs. John Magnier, Michael Tabor, Derek Smith, Westerberg, Brooke Smith, and Peter Brandt. He's a super-looking and impeccably made and bred horse, Brown said. It doesn't mean they can run. I've had good-looking, well-bred horses come to this barn before. They don't quite pan out to their expectations. But for this one, he has. He's really everything and more they thought when they bought him. Sierra Leone won his debut in November at Aqueduct. and then was beaten by a nose by Dornock over a muddy track in the Grade 2 Remsen at Aqueduct. He's 2-for-2 this year, winning the Grade 2 Risen Star at Fairgrounds and the Grade 1 Bluegrass at Keeneland. Jocker Tyler Gaffalione is 0-for-6 in the Kentucky Derby, but looks to have his best chance with Sierra Leone. "I've definitely never had these feelings before," Gaffalione said. "It's hard to put into words, but a lot of excitement." If there's one concern about Sierra Leone, it's his running style. While Fierceness has plenty of early speed and figures to be near the front, Sierra Leone is a late closer who likely will have to navigate plenty of traffic to cross the finish line first. Brown believes he has the horse to get it done. With his running style, it does create a more challenging trip, having to pass a large number of horses potentially in the race, Brown said. But in the manner in which he runs, he has a lot of confidence. He may not be the fastest horse early in his races, but once he gets moving, it does seem like his strides are probably 2 to the horses next to him. And now a rundown on the horse, trainer, jockey, and odds. Now, the Kentucky Derby is on TV, of course, at 6:57 Eastern Daylight Time on NBC tomorrow. In right close to the rail, a number one pole position is Dornock, trained by Danny Gargan, ridden by Louis Saez, and it's 20-1. Number two is Sierra Leone, trained by Chad Brown, ridden by Tyler Gaffalione, and 3-1. Three is Mystic Dan, trained by Kenny McPeak, ridden by Brian Hernandez Jr., and is 20-1. Four is Catching Freedom, trained by Brad Cox, ridden by Flavian Pratt, 8-1. Five is Catalytic, trainers Safi Joseph Jr., jockey Jose Ortiz, 30-1. Six, Just Steel, trainer D. Wayne Lucas, jockey Keith Asmussen, and 20-1. Seventh, Honor Marie, trainer Whit Beckman, jockey Ben Curtis, 20-1. Eighth, Just a Touch, trainer Brad Cox, jockey Florent Giroux, and 10-1. Number nine, T.O. Password, trainer Daisuke Takayanagi, and ridden by Kazushi Kimura at 30-1. Number 10 is Forever Young, trained by Yoshida Yahaga and ridden by Ryoichi Sakai, 10-1. 11 is Track Phantom, trainer Steve Asmussen, jockey Joel Rosario, 20-1. 12 is West Saratoga, trainer Larry Demerit, jockey Jesus Castanon, 50-1. 13 is Endlessly, trainer Michael McCarthy, jockey Umberti Rispoli, 30-1. 14th is Domestic Product, trainer Chad Brown, jockey Irad Ortiz Jr., 30-1. 15 is Grand Mo the First, trainer Victor Barboza Jr., jockey Amiciel Jaramillo, 50-1. 16th is Fierceness, Todd Pletcher is the trainer, John Velasquez the jockey, and it's 5-2. 17th is Stronghold, trainer Phil D'Amato, jockey Antonio Frezu, 20-1. 18th is Resilience, trainer Bill Mott, jockey Junior Alvarado, 20-1. 19th is Society Man, Danny Gargan is the trainer and Frankie Dettori is the jockey at 50-1. And 20th is Epic Ride, trainer John Ennis and jockey Adam Bashiza at 50-1. Just as a note, Encino, which drew the 9 post in the draw, was scratched from the race Wednesday. Now an editorial by Mike Freeman, a columnist for USA Today. Brittany Griner puts toughness, humanity, on display. The people who dislike Brittany Griner have always been a cabal of clowns and goofs, highly unserious people. They don't like her because she's openly gay, because she's a strong woman, because she's black, because they love Russia. They don't even try to cloak their hate. When Griner was sentenced to 9 years in a Russian penal colony for 2 vape cartridges that contained cannabis oil, the main thing the far right said was she broke the law, so too bad. These are the same people who support a man who kept classified documents next to his toilet. In any universe, in any place where you have a pulse, Griner is a hero. And it turns out she's a bigger hero than we actually knew. Griner has detailed her imprisonment in Russia in an upcoming memoir, Coming Home, which is scheduled to be released on Tuesday. She spoke with ABC's Robin Roberts about her book in an interview that aired Wednesday night. The interview showed with extreme clarity that even the oppressive disgrace that is Russia's judicial system, even a corrupt superpower, couldn't destroy her. That is the power of Brittany Griner. Griner survived because she's strong. She's in fact stronger than the people who criticize her. She's a 2-time Olympian and 9-time WNBA All-Star. Toughness is who she is. But also in the interview, we see her humanity. The broadcast reminds us all of Griner's impressiveness as a person. She was the first openly gay athlete to earn a Nike endorsement. She's kind, a family person, a great teammate. She's respected by everyone in the sport. It's also clear that Griner had to overcome more than just the physical strain of being in a Russian prison, but also mentally, said Jameson Firestone, an anti-corruption activist. Firestone was a lawyer in Russia when in 2009 an accountant named Sergei Magnitsky revealed a tax fraud scheme involving Russian government officials. He was falsely accused of the same crimes and put in prison, where he later died. Firestone and others in the coming years pushed for sanctions against human rights abusers. The end result was the Magnitsky Act. Few people outside of Russia know the abuses of that country's legal system better than Firestone. Griner likely had to fight between two mental states, hoping she'd be quickly released, but also realizing it was possible she might have to serve her full sentence. It's hard to survive there as a good and principled person, especially when you don't know your fate, Firestone told USA Today Sports in an email interview. When you know that you're serving 10 years, it is in some ways easier to deal with because you can adjust your life to the terrible new reality by becoming part of it. But to be in limbo, doing everything possible to keep yourself apart from succumbing to that, hoping that somehow you will be rescued, that's incredibly difficult. Griner was sentenced to 9 years in prison. For breakfast, she described eating a type of porridge that was like cement. For dinner, she ate small pieces of fish that had all the bones in it. Griner in the interview shows emotion and a sense of relief. Both things are palpable. She also clearly wanted to address some of her critics, and there were lots of them. Roberts gave Griner the opportunity to speak to skeptics who don't believe she forgot that the cannabis oil was in her bag, and instead think she was trying to sneak the drugs into Russia. I would say, have you ever forgot your keys in your car? Griner asked. Left your car running? Have you ever, where's my glasses? They're on top of your head. Where's my phone? Oh, it's in my pocket. It's just so easy to have a mental lapse. Granted, my mental lapse was on a more grand scale, but it doesn't take away from how that can happen. Griner felt extreme guilt over the entire ordeal. And that's when she began crying as she relived those emotions with Roberts. At one point in the interview, Griner, thinking back to her detainment, said, "I could just visualize everything I worked hard for crumbling and just going away." Griner says she contemplated taking her own life. She was eventually transferred to a penal colony hundreds of miles outside of Moscow, and the conditions were about what you'd expect. In her building, there were 50 to 60 women and one bathroom. 3 toilets, no hot water. There was a communal sink that everyone used. The mattress had a huge blood stain on it, Griner said, and they give you these 2 thin sheets, so you're basically laying on bars. Her legs, from the middle of her shin down to her feet, stuck through the bars. Which in prison, she said, you don't really want to stick your leg and arm through bars. Because someone could go up and grab it, break it, twist it, and that's what was going through my mind. When Griner got home, she enjoyed the things we all take for granted. She got Whataburger, some barbecue, Dr. Pepper, and Cheetos. In Russia, the other prisoners called her the American, or the basketball player. We should call her something else. The toughest of heroes. And now an article on the NBA by Jeff Zilgit, a columnist for the USA Today. Hold the applause for top seed Celtics. Boston finished off Miami in the NBA playoffs, but the team still has a ways to go to win the title. No need to drape the Boston Celtics with too much praise. The number one seed did what it was supposed to do, beat the number eight seed Miami Heat. The Celtics had a disappointing Game 2 loss, won the next two games in Miami for a 3-1 series lead, and finished off the Heat in Game 5 without injured forward center Kristaps Porzingis. They left no doubt, building a 30-point first-half lead and a 118-84 victory Wednesday over the depleted Heat. Jaylen Brown and Derek White each scored 25 points, and Jason Tatum had 16 points and 12 rebounds. Advancing to the Eastern Conference semifinals is exactly where the Celtics should be, awaiting the winner of the Orlando-Cleveland series. They passed a minor test against a team without Jimmy Butler and Terry Rozier for the entire series and avoided a Game 6 and that pressure that accompanies the potential of a Game 7. They faced a modicum of adversity, the sports kind, not the real-life kind, and came through. For this franchise and this roster, first-round victories are not celebrations. It's a necessary stop on the way to something bigger. A championship is the goal. The Celtics have 17 of them, tied with the Los Angeles Lakers for most in NBA history. This particular team with Tatum and Brown have knocked at the door. Four conference finals and an NBA Finals appearance since Tatum's rookie year in 2017-18. But no title since 2008. After losing to the Heat in last season's Eastern Conference Finals, President of Basketball Operations Brad Stevens tinkered with the roster in the offseason, acquiring Jrue Holiday and Porzingis. It helped lead to a league-best 64-18 record, and Stevens was named Executive of the Year. But an award without a title doesn't mean as much in the Celtics sphere. During Boston's Game 5 demolition, TNT play-by-play announcer Brian Anderson said, "It does feel like it's going to be a disappointment if they don't win at all this season." TNT analyst and former NBA coach Stan Van Gundy said, "That's the mentality they want." Of these recent Celtics teams, this is the best one by the eye test and the analytics. Boston has all-stars and all-NBA players, and with the number one offense and number two defense, it was just one of two teams to finish in the top four in both categories. Oklahoma City was the other. In the conference semifinals, the Celtics will play a healthier and better team than they did in the first round. And whether it's the Cavaliers or the Magic, the Celtics will face a quality defense. It's another test and should be more difficult than the first round, especially with Porzingis expected to miss a few more games. But degree of difficulty is irrelevant for the Celtics. All that matters is getting to the conference finals. That's where the Celtics should be later in May. And now on to the WNBA, with an article by Chloe Peterson, who writes for the Indianapolis Star and the USA Today Network. Fever vet makes Clark feel welcome. Dateline Indianapolis. As the Indiana Fever prepared to make their number one pick on draft night, point guard Erica Wheeler sat in Gainbridge Fieldhouse, squeezing the hands of teammates Lexi Hull and Maya Caldwell. They all knew what name was coming, but the anticipation of it being official captivated the three teammates, as well as the fans who came to watch with them. As Caitlin Clark's name came through the Fieldhouse Jumbotron, all three of them jumped up, Wheeler fist-pumping and clapping in celebration. They already had the Fever's red alternate Rebel jerseys ready with Clark's name and number 22 on the back, and they didn't waste any time putting them on. Later on, during draft night, as Clark was bouncing from different media obligations, Wheeler tried to FaceTime her. While Clark didn't pick up during the night, Wheeler still wanted to be one of the first to welcome her to Indianapolis. I put it as like, you know, when you go to a different school, The first day of school, you don't know anybody, Wheeler said. Then you find that one person that says hi to you, and they become your best friend. For me, I just wanted to get ahead of it because I know this transition is tough. Wheeler, the teammate who plays the same position as the Iowa superstar, isn't the person you'd expect to be the most excited about Clark coming to town. With the coveted number one pick coming in to play point guard, Wheeler's on-court role will likely drastically change. But Wheeler isn't the type of person to have anything against someone who simply plays the same position as her. She's the type of person to help someone, no matter what, and give them the support they need to get through an immense change in such a short amount of time. And she wanted to make sure the Fever's newest player knew that coming in. It's how I was raised. I don't have no hate in my heart, Wheeler said. I want everybody around me to win. Whether you're winning or not, I still want to push you to be great. So for me, I just thought, like, if I get ahead of it, I'm just making it comfortable right away. It's just an easy, smooth transition. For me, I actually love it because I like being a big sister. I like helping first. I don't really like getting help. So it's refreshing for me to be able to help her and be her big sister. 3 weeks later, Wheeler has been the one teammate Clark has consistently pointed to as the person who has helped her the most. I think she's somebody that simply wants the best for people, no matter what, Clark said. People can say that, but she really lives it, every day. And you can tell that she's going to push me, hold me accountable. She's going to find ways to help me learn. But at the same time, she's going to have my back every single day. And that's something I'm really grateful for coming into this league. Having a vet that really wants the best for you is special. Wheeler, who started at point guard last season, is entering the final year of her contract and will likely either back up Clark at point guard or play out of position in the starting lineup. Throughout the first 2 days of training camp, Coach Christy Sides experimented with lineups. There were times Wheeler and Clark were on the floor with the starting lineup. Regular starter and WNBA All-Star Kelsey Mitchell is out with an ankle injury. And other times when Wheeler ran with the second unit. But Wheeler doesn't have an ego about these things, Sides said. She's an embodiment of the we, not me mentality Sides pushes in their culture. All she wants to do is whatever this team needs, whatever she needs to do for us to be successful, Sides said. And I can ask her for anything. If I'm going to tell her she's going to come off the bench, she's going to come off the bench. If I tell her I need her to do this, she's going to do that. I mean, that's just who she is. Her voice and her leadership, it just means so much to our entire team. And now an article on pro golf by Adam Shupak, who writes for Golf Week and USA Today Network. Matt Wallace opens CJ Cup with an 8-under 63. Dateline McKinney, Texas. Matt Wallace hated missing the Masters in April, but he learned a few important lessons from watching it on TV. Interestingly, he didn't take those pointers from watching world number one Scottie Scheffler's dominance performance. It's difficult to take a lot from him because he's playing unbelievable golf, Wallace said. Rather, Wallace has tried to mimic the focus of Swedish sensation Ludvig Åberg, and it worked wonders Thursday in the opening round of the CJ Cup Byron Nelson. Wallace birdied his first three holes and five of the first six out of the gate to race to the top of the leaderboard and shoot 8-under par 63 at TPC Craig Ranch for a one-stroke lead on Thursday. It's the dream start you want for any round. And from there, my mindset was to take care of my business, take care of my shot, and not care so much about what the outcome is, but just put the best move that I can on it, Wallace explained. It's been a disappointing season for Wallace, who's recorded just one top 25 finish to date and took 3 weeks off in April to rest his left shoulder, an injury he blamed on overplaying. Then I slept on a funny at the Cognizant in early March and I had to go and get it looked at straight away. I thought I was going to be out for about 6 weeks, he said. Wallace called this season terrible, but he's been playing long enough to know it's a long season and there is much golf still to be played. I've been so far away from where I've wanted to be and how I've wanted to play that it feels terrible. It's probably not terrible, but it just feels that way. said Wallace, who claimed he felt a round like this was brewing after his improved iron play last week at the Zurich Classic of New Orleans. I came in this week with that belief. Things have felt like they were turning around. I know what I can do in this game. Statistically, Wallace enjoyed his best ball striking round of the season, and his 63 marked a career low round. That was one shot better than the trio of Sweden's Alex Noren, who enjoyed fresh greens in the first group of the day, Canadian Taylor Bendrith, who was recovering from his own shoulder injury, and American Chesson Hadley, who raved about the three-wood he smashed from 256 yards at 18 for one final birdie. That was tingles and jingles, said Hadley, who birdied half the holes, including five in a row beginning at the fifth. Landed perfect. Overnight rain into the morning delayed the start of the tournament for 1 hour, and officials instituted preferred lies in the fairways for the opening round due to wet conditions. That and soft conditions and little wind meant par took a beating from most of the field. You got to get it this week every round, said Hadley, who had missed four consecutive cuts before making the weekend in New Orleans in the team event. I think I played well today because of last week. I'm such a huge momentum player. Defending champion Jason Day posted 5-under-66 and was content with his start, but knows he'll have to keep chasing birdies. I think overall the average winning score is 22-under around here. You kind of have to shoot 5 or 6-under a day. Somewhere in that region, he said. Kind of on par right now, so good. Got 3 more days left. Day played alongside Dallas native Jordan Spieth, who finished with a bogey to leave a sour taste in his mouth about his 3-under-68. Doesn't look like we're going to get a ton of wind or anything, so I'm going to have to really make it up, because there'll be a lot of guys shooting low scores, he said. Rookie Raul Parida recorded the shot of the day, a hole-in-one at the 236-yard par 3 7th. Parida used a 4-iron for his first ace on the PGA Tour and 6th in his lifetime. Asked what he did with the ball, he said it was tucked safely in his bag. I'm going to keep that one, he said. It's my first one. I'll give the other ones away. And that concludes USA Today Sports through Radio Reading Services. Stay healthy.